This episode is brought to you by ServiceNow, the AI platform for business transformation. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. Enter ServiceNow. It puts AI to work for people, for employees, for developers, and even your customers, removing frustration and supercharging productivity. On our intelligent platform, AI isn't just a promise. It's happening today. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. To learn more, visit servicenow.com/AI for people.
I'm Tyrus.
I'm Liz Claman.
I'm Greg Jarrett, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Wednesday, April 24th, 2024. I'm Lisa Brady. In the months following the Hamas attacks on Israel, some college protests in the U.S. supporting Palestinians have taken a drastic turn.
It's no longer just an anti-Israel thing. It's a pro-terror, it's anti-American, it's anti-Western.
I'm Dave Anthony. How far can a community go to fight homelessness? Grants Pass, Oregon has taken its plan to ban sleeping in public places to the Supreme Court.
These localities, such as Grants Pass, Oregon, are saying to the courts that, you know, you've hamstrung us. We hear from our communities, they want something done about this problem, and we can't do anything based upon, as a result of these regulations that courts have placed on us.
And I'm Carol Markowitz. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
They're picketing, chanting, and pitching tents on more college campuses from New York to California. Pro-Palestinian protesters showing solidarity with what started a week ago at Columbia University, setting up tents on the New York City campus, ultimately leading to arrests and disrupting education. Columbia is now offering a hybrid model for the rest of the semester. At NYU, hundreds of students walked out of class yesterday after clashes with police and more than 100 arrests Monday night.
The number of bottles that were thrown, chairs thrown at them. People who peacefully protest for an issue, they're not throwing bottles and chairs.
Mayor Eric Adams suggesting outside agitators are part of it. The student group Students for Justice in Palestine, or SJP, also organizes many events. Some protesters openly support Hamas and carry signs that say resistance is not terrorism. Deputy White House Press Secretary Andrew Bates telling reporters,
echoing the rhetoric of terrorist organizations, especially in the wake of the worst massacre committed against the Jewish people since the Holocaust, is despicable.
Bates says calls for violence and intimidation against Jews have no place on any college campus. He spoke while traveling with President Biden, who had criticism for both sides, while answering a reporter's question about protests Monday.
I condemn the anti-Semitic protests. That's why I've set up a program to deal with that. I also condemn those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians.
The president continues to face political pressure within his own party over the devastation in Gaza as Israel fights Hamas after Hamas attacked Israel. War changing the climate for Jewish students in the U.S.
Before October 7th, I really didn't feel that there was anti-Semitism or a strong sense of anti-Israel hate at all.
Talia Khan is an MIT graduate student and president of the MIT Israel Alliance.
I would hear from some Israeli friends of mine that, you know, at a party, some drunk guy would make a comment about there having been, the Israeli student having been in the IDF and blah, 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 something nasty. But that was really like a one-off thing. And I guess overall, it seemed that students, you know, didn't know that much about the conflict, didn't really care about it. You know, there was a strong pro-Israel, Israel as a tech startup nation kind of vibe about MIT. A lot of students who were not Jewish would go on. We have an Israel internship program called MIT Israel program, the MISTI program. And a lot of students would spend their summers in Israel and go during the, we have a January term also where people would do internships. So a lot of non-Jewish students were, you know, whether or not they were pro-Israel, anti-Israel, at least they were, you know, positive about Israel in that they were willing to go to Israel and do research there and came back with positive things to say about the country and you know, how fun it was, how good of a research environment it was. So that was definitely the vibe before October 7th.
Did it change immediately after October 7th, or did it change over time in the days and weeks following, or did it not change until protests started erupting?
So immediately after, on October 7th, the people who hated Israel already, so there was already an anti-Israel club called the CIA, and those people immediately started posting horrible things and saying, like, the people who were killed, you know, essentially what we saw at a lot of these universities, saying that all the people were killed, it's Israel's fault, and, like, posting images of Hamas standing on Israeli tanks and hailing them as heroes, you know, just some really terrible stuff immediately after October 7th. But I thought, you know, I thought that the general vibe would be of people on campus would just be, you know, it's horrible that Israel got attacked and that innocent people were killed, kidnapped, raped, etc. But over time, I think we have seen the brainwashing of a lot of people who were, you know, neutral or didn't really know that much about it, the brainwashing via TikTok and other social media and other, you know, propaganda from groups like SJP, which the CIA, the anti-Israel MIT group, is affiliated with, of just regular students. And now it's become more popular to, even if you don't really know that much, just be like, oh yeah, Israel's the bad one, you know, anti-Israel, free Palestine. So I think that definitely it's grown. And we see that these people are not just, you know, it's not just hating Israel. They're pro-terror now. And I think that was a switch that I only saw in the past few months, you know, in this new year. And I'm not exactly sure how it got to the point where instead of just saying we hate Israel, but we're anti-terrorists, that people are actively pro-terrorists now. So that extends to, you know, becoming more anti-American. And so it's no longer just an anti-Israel thing. It's a pro-terror, it's anti-American, it's anti-Western, and it's kind of morphing and becoming more and more radical each and every day.
Do you or your friends feel as though, you know, that's the part that's really fueling the safety concerns, that's making Jewish students feel less safe? I mean, if protesters were focused squarely on, let's say, concern for civilians dying in Gaza, you know, would that make a difference in this whole climate that's happening on campuses?
I think you really just kind of nailed it in the head. Like, that is exactly what it is. It's not that, you know, it's totally acceptable for people to be concerned about innocent people being killed in war. And I totally empathize with, you know, people saying, you know, people caring about that and people being worried about innocent people dying in wartime. What I don't have a lot of empathy for is people saying, we love Hamas, we are Hamas, and we want another October 7th to happen every single day. These were things that were said in the Columbia protests and at these encampments that are popping up at universities across the country. These students are saying, we ally ourselves and we stand by everything that's happening at the Columbia protest, the Columbia encampment. We have had students on MIT's campus who are part of these demonstrations say that they believe that violence against any Zionist is justified, whether it's a woman, child, whatever. And these direct calls for violence towards any Zionist, the vast majority of Jews, and also many Christians are Zionists. You know, there's many non-religious people who are Zionists. So it's very scary that these people are allying themselves with terrorist organizations that are calling to spread jihad and Sharia law throughout, you know, all of America, throughout the whole world.
President Biden has said he condemns anti-Semitic protests, but also condemns those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians. How does that make you feel? Is there something that you think he could do or say that would help the situation?
I think the both sides-ism that we've been seeing from President Biden and also our university administrators, there has never been a Jewish student on our campus who has ever done a protest saying anything against, you know, innocent Palestinians or saying, like, we don't understand the, like, why you're sad about, you know, innocent Palestinians being killed. Like, that's not what this is about. All of the pro-Israel protesters have, you know, you can see it very clearly when you go to any of these counter protests. You have American flags and Israeli flags, people singing songs of peace, singing songs and saying, like, we want peace, we want to come together, we want to rebuild our community. And the other side is yelling for literally the genocide of the Jews, saying from water to water, Palestine will be Arab, and burning flags, burning American flags, burning Israeli flags. So when you have this both sides ism, it's pretty frustrating because, you know, we're not instigating anything. You know, the pro-Israel demonstrators are not instigating. They're not, you know, calling for anything that's anti-Palestinian, calling for anything that's anti-Arab or anti-Muslim. All we've ever called for on MIT's campus, and of course I can't speak for, you know, everyone everywhere, but I would say that the vast majority of these pro-Israel demonstrations are really just calling for peace and togetherness. And so, you know, to hear President Biden play this both sides-ism is really just disappointing, and it just doesn't depict reality.
One social media influencer says he does feel like Gen Z is being brainwashed, especially on TikTok with the anti-Israel messaging, including Holocaust denialism. But I spoke with a Harvard professor, Arthur C. Brooks, who says he thinks Gen Z might be the ones to turn a culture of fear and contempt on campuses around, to push back and say we want to be happy and ultimately return things to a healthy debate on campuses and a more civil discourse. Do you think that that's possible? Are you hopeful all of this is just temporary, or does this feel like, you know, some kind of a sea change to you?
I sure hope that professor is right, but I don't see it happening. Looking at all of these campuses, I'm scared. Even this morning, I was thinking to myself, my God, I am scared for the future. You know, Gen Z has like a record number of Holocaust deniers, record numbers of people, you know, who are supporting Hamas, who just are incredibly radicalized. And I am not confident, given the makeup of faculty at these elite universities and the lack of diversity in, you know, political opinion, social opinion amongst faculties at elite universities, I'm not convinced that they are going to guide these students to be free thinking or open minded. I think that they're going to push them further and further. And I think that as these students become then faculty, they're just going to guide everybody, you know, further and further towards this like radical corner.
I was actually going to ask you, what would your message be to college administrators on how to address safety concerns, especially, you know, given that they also express free speech concerns?
I mean, like, safety concerns is simple. These pro-terror encampments, aside from the fact that they're spewing genocidal rhetoric that Congress has deemed anti-Semitic, like, they need to go. They're also, you know, disrupting students sleeping. Like, the one at MIT is right by all of the dorms. MIT and all these universities need to enforce their time, place, manner restrictions. They need to enforce their codes of conduct, and they need to enforce disciplinary measures. You know, MIT was giving this excuse for not enforcing its disciplinary measures on the students who are part of the anti-Israel club because a lot of these students are on visas. The thing is, at this point, these students have violated the rules so many times, and they know that MIT won't do anything about it. So they're just emboldened to keep going, to be, you know, more radical. And if MIT, you know, they should know, if you have a visa, there are things that you shouldn't do. You shouldn't continue violating rules if you know that that's going to put your visa in danger. And MIT needs to stop giving these students with visas a free pass just because they have visas. They need to treat all the students, you know, equally, and they need to enforce their rules equally on all groups and individuals.
Talia Khan, MIT graduate student, also president of the MIT Israel Alliance. We thank you very much for your time, especially during Passover. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
This is Carol Markowitz with your Fox News commentary coming up.
Is it cruel to force homeless people out of a public park? That's a question the Supreme Court's considering.
The ordinances, by design, make it physically impossible for homeless people to live in Grants Pass without facing endless fines and jail time.
Kelsey Corcoran is an attorney representing those who've challenged Grants Pass, Oregon's ordinances against sleeping outdoors in public as unconstitutional, amounting to cruel and unusual punishment, saying the city offers no viable shelter. But Grants Pass attorney Theane Evangelos argued at Monday's Supreme Court hearing they aren't criminalizing homelessness.
Is that not what your statute does?
The statute does not say anything about homelessness. It's a generally applicable law. It's very important that it applies to everyone.
Yeah, I got that. But it's a single person with a blanket. And you don't have to have a tent. You don't have to have a camp.
Justice Elena Kagan wasn't alone in her skepticism. Justice Sonia Sotomayor asked if every place passed a law like Grants Pass, where would homeless people sleep? Are they supposed to kill themselves not sleeping? But Justice Neil Gorsuch also asked, do the homeless have a constitutional right to urinate in public? Chief Justice John Roberts also suggested communities don't have resources for everything.
Do you build the homeless shelter or do you take care of the lead pipes? What is there aren't isn't enough fire protection? Which one do you prioritize?
A ruling may not come until June.
Homelessness really is one of the defining social problems of our time, particularly on the West Coast.
Stephen Ide is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, author of a book titled Homelessness in America, The History and Tragedy of an Intractable Social Problem.
What has happened over the past 5 years or so is that courts have become increasingly involved in homelessness, mostly as a result of restricting localities' ability to restrict public camping within their borders, particularly the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals based in California. And as a result, these localities, such as Grants Pass, Oregon, are saying to the courts that, you know, you've hamstrung us. We hear from our communities, they want something done about this problem, and we can't do anything based upon, as a result of these regulations that courts have placed on us. And so that is why Grants Pass has appealed this case all the way up to the highest court in the land.
Right, because they're accused basically of being cruel and unusual, enforcing ordinances, making homeless people move out of places and parks without a place to go. That's the argument against these ordinances, right? That there's no place Grants Pass is providing as alternative. Is that correct?
Basically, yes. Yeah, progressive advocates say the Eighth Amendment has this provision prohibiting cruel and unusual punishment. If you fine someone for camping in a park and they say they have nowhere else to go, then that amounts to cruel and unusual punishment. And that's the argument that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has found persuasive. But we will have to see if the Supreme Court finds it persuasive.
Now, I saw an interview with a woman who is homeless in Grants Pass, and she's been moving park to park and place to place. And she says that she's racked up fines she can't pay. She also, because police forced them to move, she said she was moving her stuff from one park to another, and it took more than one trip. And she put her stuff in a park, came back, and when she went back with her next load of her property, police had already confiscated it, and it was gone, including the urn of a stillborn child. So obviously, these are people, which is it's frustrating for everybody in this, how to deal with people. Some of them are down on their luck. Others may be drug addicts. I mean, this is a very difficult problem.
Yes. And in fact, that was one of the lead themes of Monday's hearing, the complexity of this problem, which everyone agrees. The homeless population is very complex. The population has all kinds of problems. Governments are saying we want a complex or multifaceted response to this problem of homelessness. It's important to listen to what the local governments are saying. And by the way, this is not just conservative towns. This is all kinds of Democratic politicians have spoken up criticizing the Ninth Circuit's jurisprudence in places like Grants Pass. And they're saying that you're not giving us the flexibility. None of these governments are saying this is all about only law enforcement. Police is the be all and end all of our solution to homelessness. We want a large toolbox. We want a lot of different things, but we do want these ordinances as one tool among many. For example, we want to encourage people into shelter, but when we can't have any way to, say, prevent people from sleeping in a park, it's harder to encourage people into shelter. So this is about, can this be one tool among many in locality's solution to homelessness?
San Francisco filed an amicus brief in this case saying the city spent $672 million last year to provide shelter and housing to the homeless, yet public encampments, people on the streets, still on the rise.
The sums invested in homeless services over the past 5-10 years, particularly in California, have been historic. I mean, billions upon billions. And oftentimes, these have been directly authorized by the public. California does a lot by, you know, ballot initiative, like, are you willing to raise taxes to provide more money for homeless services? Like, yes, yes. Publics in California have frequently answered yes to that question. As a result, you have these systems with, you know, leading to huge sums invested. And yet homeless totals have risen at the same time. And so if you understand and look carefully at what the court is requiring, it's saying, like, basically those sums are not enough. Who knows what sums would be enough to satisfy these courts' requirements to provide shelter, adequate shelter, according to every homeless person in your community's needs and desires. How much would that cost? And this estimates are truly extraordinary. And that is why some critics have focused on the just basic unworkability of these rulings.
So why, if there's more shelter space and more availability, why do people in the homeless community, why do they not want to go?
Yeah. So two of the most complicated questions are, you know, who is truly involuntarily homeless? Who actually has some sort of a choice? Maybe it's not their ideal choice, but they have some sort of alternative to sleeping in a public park. And on the other hand, in what cases is shelter adequate? So oftentimes homeless people, they have a pet, they have a dog that they are taking care of. And the shelter, for reasons of just basic management and trying to maintain an orderly environment, does not allow pets. So they say, well, that's a deal breaker. I can't go in as a result of that. And then also maybe you shouldn't be able to find me for camping in a park because that shelter is not adequate to my needs. When digging down into the complexity of this population, you know, people who have addiction, who can't be conformed to sobriety requirements, people who have untreated mental illness, who can be even like difficult to have a conversation with in terms of on the ground outreach workers. What does adequate shelter mean for those people?
Stephen, do you know, is there a good number, a percentage of how many people who are homeless are either drug addicts or have untreated mental illness? Do we know?
Well, it is a hard population that can be difficult to study. But I think a standard estimate would be, in terms of the hardcore street population, the people living on the street, the unsheltered population, over 50% have some sort of mental disorder or drug addiction easily.
Okay.
You know, we should look at lots of things, you know, laws regard, you know, what is happening with drugs and the opioid crisis. That is a very pertinent question to what people mean by the homelessness crisis. But that was not taken up at all in Monday's hearing. So the Grants Pass attorneys and Grants Pass itself and the municipalities who share the opinion of Grants Pass are saying, we are not saying this is, you know, the end. This is going to be the end. But we are, you know, unusually constrained in our ability to use this one tool that we think is necessary. It would be better if we could implement these reasonable restrictions on public camping. We could do more to incentivize people to maybe give shelter another shot. And this is what you are not letting us do. And you're leaving us with basically no options.
Okay. Could there be some sort, a lot of times the Supreme Court likes to find a lane or a narrow ruling. Is there a way they could say, well, in order to have an ordinance like in Grants Pass, they have to have a shelter alternative?
Yes. There's always this question about, you know, how broad the ruling will be. And that partly means, will there be more litigation after this? Will it absolutely like slam the door on more like lawsuits coming from homeless people and their lawyers saying that I've been treated very unfairly? Or will it, you know, give more flexibility but allow the some of that litigation to still go on? You know, one of the things that communities have complained about is saying that, like, as the Ninth Circuit rulings have been interpreted by lower courts, they're saying that we have to provide shelter for the entire local homeless population, or we can't move to regulate, you know, what's going on in public places. Shelter is a good thing to invest in. Like, we need shelter, but it's very expensive, especially when you're talking about a city with, you know, 10, 20, 30,000 people in it. You know, tax bases only have so much capacity in them. So people, you know, who followed the hearing carefully are not entirely sure how this is going to break. But certainly it wouldn't be surprising if this is not just like an absolute green light to municipalities saying, you know, go right ahead, do whatever you want.
Now, there are people in these communities that say, what about my rights? I should be able to go to a public park and not have to worry about homeless people or people who are drug users or needles. I mean, that's the other side of this coin. You've talked to some of the people in Grants Pass.
They just can't use these parks. You know, they're paying for them. They're taxpayers. So this is, from their perspective, an absolutely outrageous situation. In a way, these public places have become privatized, that people are living out of them. So the people who are living out of them, like, it's their park, but there's really no one else's park. So civic life really is harmed by the situation with homelessness in many of these West Coast communities. And that is why, you know, municipalities are saying it's so urgent that we have these policy solutions.
You've studied this for years. Does anyone have a solution that's not been tried?
Well, I think that, I mean, because of the money and because of the urgency, they're trying new things. You know, there's a debate between giving somebody an alternative to public places, does that mean giving an apartment that he can stay in for the rest of his life, or some sort of, you know, temporary situation, a shelter? What does it mean by shelter? Maybe we need to think about different models of shelter, these tiny home villages. So there is some experimentation going on. This is not just, and the response to homelessness has not been just, like, you know, universally cruel. That is, that's not an accurate characterization. As I said, the public has been willing to raise taxes on itself to fund these programs. But the crisis has become so extreme in places like San Francisco and Los Angeles. You do face a, you know, grim prospect. I mean, if the situation in San Francisco got, you know, one third of the better, you would still have a very profound humanitarian crisis. But you do have to start somewhere, and giving municipalities more authority would be a good place to start.
Stephen Ide, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, author of the book Homelessness in America. Great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks again for having me.
And in other news,
I'm Gianna Gelosi. Pretty women can inspire men to tell the truth and women to lie. That's the findings of a new study published in the Journal of Economic Behavior and Organization, which looked into how a woman's appearance impacts the moral behavior of others. Researchers in Tel Aviv gave women and men, 110 individuals each, a questionnaire with an image of a woman attached and falsely told participants it was the face of a scientist leading the study. Half of the questionnaires featured an image of a typically attractive woman and the other half a less attractive woman. The results showed that men were more likely to behave more honestly when they believed they were interacting with a beautiful woman, while the opposite pattern was seen in the female participants who exhibited a beauty penalty towards attractive women, as the study authors put it. The woman's reaction was chalked up to negative emotional priming of female jealousy and envy, while the men's was linked to something called the beauty premium, which is a previously proven phenomenon where beautiful people are assumed to have good character traits. For the Fox News Rundown, I'm Gianna Gelosi.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
I'm Dana Perino. This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by founder and executive director of Power the Future, Daniel Turner, for a look at how we can advocate for a cleaner earth while strengthening U.S. energy independence. Available now on foxnewspodcast.com.
Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Carol Markowitz.
What's on your mind?
Florida has long been a popular destination during the winter months. Whether the Panhandle's beaches, the theme parks of Orlando, or the quieter Gulf Coast, the state had something for everyone. But for years, everyone knew that Miami Beach was best avoided in the spring break months of March and April. South Beach, in particular, on the southern tip, was a rowdy place to be. Fights, garbage, and arrests were all standard. The crowds were excessive and felt dangerous. It was certainly not somewhere for families to visit. This year, Stephen Miner, the new mayor of Miami Beach, elected just in November, pledged to put an end to that reputation. Our family vacationed on Miami Beach a few weekends ago to see for ourselves. The change from previous years was dramatic. Police were very present, but quietly so. It didn't seem like a scary environment that required police presence, just that they were around in case of any problems. The city felt safer, but also cleaner and more organized. Disorderly crowds were nowhere to be seen. I had assumed they achieved this result with more arrests, but in fact, arrests were down this year from previous years. It turns out deterrence played an important role. The city ran an ad campaign that had gone viral online, breaking up with spring break. I spoke with Mayor Miner about the city's success. He told me, quote, the ad campaign was instrumental, end quote, to the positive outcome. The ad campaign warned people coming to vacation on Miami Beach that the city wouldn't stand for bad behavior. Just saying so helped control that bad behavior. Of course, it couldn't be done with a good ad alone. Miner told me that they had a united front. From government agencies to businesses, everyone wanted a safer, happier spring break scene. Quote, everyone is saying enough is enough, Miner said. Law and order are priority number one. Governor Ron DeSantis visited several times and said he would provide whatever the city needed. The state was a great partner and came through for us. The county gave us many police officers. Everyone was on the same page, end quote. As part of Miner's 14-point plan, neighboring police departments stepped in to help too. It makes sense. When bad behavior is happening on Miami Beach, it could easily spill over into other areas. Most of all, the city of Miami Beach simply enforced laws that were already on the books. Open container laws and the city's noise ordinance already existed, but demanding they be followed went a long way to curbing other lawbreaking. The mayor told me the city had no fatalities, no stampedes during spring break time as they had in previous years. The message of the Miami Beach cleanup to other cities is it doesn't have to be this way. Miami Beach has shown that good coordination among government agencies leads to good results, but they've also shown that enforcing the law and telling visitors they plan to do so leads to more law-abiding behavior. Much of it is not rocket science. Cities that have allowed themselves to spiral into being targets for crime largely don't enforce existing laws. Miami Beach has drawn a line in their soft white sand. Not here, not anymore. This is Carol Markowitz.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.